Jason S., our Al-Anon speaker. Jason?
Yes, hi there. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Ian, thank you so much. I was really actually riveted by your share, particularly about your just sharing about your relationship to your father, because I'm going to be doing something similar as well. So it really spoke to me, your share tonight. Thank you. So let's see. Before I go further, I wanted to put in a plug, an advertisement for how useful it is to volunteer to be a speaker, either at a meeting like this or in our own smaller meetings. Because since I volunteered some months ago, I have been really giving a lot of thought to me and my relationship to the program and what I've been learning in the program, because I was going to be talking about that. And so volunteering to be a speaker helped me clarify things and to focus more than I usually do about how this phenomenal program, this precious program we call Al-Anon, has been of such usefulness and relevance to me. So I wanted to put in a plug to everyone to give that some thought. Although it's also a nerve-wracking, it's a nerve-wracking experience. Well, I always get a bit of stage fright, and my perfectionism kicks in, and I want to do a perfect job of totally summarizing the Al-Anon program in a half hour so that nothing will be left out. So I'm going to acknowledge from the get-go that I'm going to leave a lot of stuff out, and so be it, because I try to embrace the idea of progress, not perfection. When I get caught up in my perfectionism, it is totally self-oppressive, as some of you may very well know for yourselves too. So I've had two distinct phases in my participation in Al-Anon. I first got involved with Al-Anon, and Al-Anon first got involved with me in the late 80s and the early 90s when I participated in the adult children-focused Al-Anon meetings. I was in my probably late 30s or around 40 years old at that time. Didn't yet have my daughter, but I definitely was looking at the legacies that I was feeling the effects of growing up in a family where there was addiction and dysfunction and neglect, emotional neglect and abandonment. So I did that for a couple of years, and then I felt that really gained a lot. And then decades passed, and my daughter was born. She's now 24 years old. She was born when I was 46 years old, and she became my second qualifier. And if there's time today, I might talk more about my daughter and what I've learned in my relationship with her through the program. But that's what brought me back to Al-Anon. And at that point, which is about 4 years ago, I focused a lot, almost primarily, on going to Al-Anon meetings with a parent focus. These days, I go to at least three meetings a week, parent meetings. Now, the Walnut Creek meeting on Monday night, there's a San Ramon meeting on Sunday night, and a Mill Valley parents meeting on Saturday morning in Marin, which, believe it or not, has anywhere from 80 to 100 people typically each Saturday. It's really a very powerful meeting. So I wanted to talk today about lessons that were taught along the way as I was growing up, what I learned, what I absorbed. We all have impressions that we take on about how life works from the families we grow up in. So I want to talk about the lessons taught along the way. And I wanted to talk about the assumptions about life that I concluded often when I was a child about how life works, and then talk about the lessons that I've been learning from the program. The program has allowed me to, bit by bit, increasingly dispel the earlier impressions and assumptions I've made about life, which were not particularly functional or healthy. So when I think about my childhood, I wanted to share with you some true memories from childhood to give you a sense of how my mind worked as I was a developing child. So in first grade, so I'm 5 years old, 6 years old at this point. The school I went to, I grew up in Queens, in New York City. Queens is one of the five boroughs of New York. And Queens at that time had about 2 million people in it. And New York City has five boroughs, had about 10 million. So it's a huge place. But in Queens, you live in different little neighborhoods. My neighborhood was called Whitestone. was near the Bronx Whitestone Bridge, for those of you from back east. In first grade, I went to a school that when there was recess time and it was raining outside, we would have recess instead of going outside. We'd have recess in this big basement area in the bottom of the school, in the basement of the school, which to a 5-6-year-old was huge. And there was a game that the teachers would organize us in. And this game worked as follows. The teacher would have us count off 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. And the point of the game is we'd all be in a big circle. And then the teacher would call out, okay, number three. And all the number threes would run into the center of the circle, jump up and down and cheer. And everybody would have a good time. And then they would go back to the outside circle. That was the first grade game. So this is an early impression of childhood. The teacher at that point, who was allocating the numbers, looked at me very intently like this. And she said to me, you're number four. Remember that. And I always have. This is 60 some odd years ago that I was impressioned with that message from an adult. You're number four. Remember that. She didn't say, hey, you're number four for the purposes of this game we're going to play today. And afterward, you can forget about it. No, this is your number four. Remember that. And I always have, and I probably always will. Now, there's a point to the story, and I'll weave it in later. But this is something I learned from an authority figure as a child. I'm number four. That's important. Remember it. I don't know why, but I have to absorb it. Around that same time in my life, and I lived in Whitestone, like I said, and I lived on a street, 20th Avenue, which was a long street that was a dead-end street. There was about 20 single-family homes on the street. And it was the street, 20th Avenue, was right next to what's called Francis Lewis Boulevard, a big boulevard that there were a lot of traffic on, including trucks. And being 5-6 years old, I noticed there was a very distinctive truck or trucks that would sometimes go on Francis Lewis Boulevard, and they were a bright yellow. And this is in the 1950s. You didn't see bright colored trucks or vehicles in those days. There was a bright yellow truck that would periodically rumble by. And I remember thinking to myself as a kid, this is a true story. I wonder what those yellow trucks are for. Because as a child, I'm trying to piece together how life works. I think we all do this to one degree or another. I already knew about number four. That was important. I didn't know why, but I'll remember that. These big yellow trucks, what are they for? So one day, I was walking home from kindergarten, and I come down my dead-end street. And lo and behold, on this long street, there's one of these yellow trucks. I'd never seen one there before. They were always on the boulevard. And this truck was a big rig. So it was back. It was stuck because it was a dead-end street. So it was backing up, going forward, backing up, trying to turn itself around on the street so it could exit. But all I saw was the yellow truck going forward, backing up, going forward, backing up. And then I noticed that as it was backing up, we had recently planted on the front of my house along the green strip right next to the concrete, next to the curb, a new tree, a new sapling. And that yellow truck backed up, and I watched it knock the tree down. And I looked at that, whoa. And I swear, this is what I said to myself, oh, that's what those yellow trucks are for. They go through neighborhoods knocking down trees. And I was very pleased to know that. It made perfect sense to me. I was basing it on my experience. Now, this is really a true story. A couple of years later, after I had learned to read a bit, I again saw that yellow truck, one of those yellow trucks on the boulevard. But this time, I saw the symbol on the side of the truck, and I was able to read what it said. And look what it said, Rheingold beer. Rheingold beer, which distinctive trademark in New York, was a bright yellow truck. And at that point, a couple of years later, something else clicked into place. And I said, oh, my original assumption about those trucks existing to knock down trees was wrong. This is a delivery truck. I said this to myself, this is a delivery truck. And that was an accident on my street back then. And I was very pleased to have learned something and updated my assumption about something. Now, these are cute stories, right? True stories. But I wanted to share these with you to illustrate because I also got other messages growing up in my family. For example, my father, one of his most well-used expressions with me was he would look at me with a look of disdain on his face and a look of contempt on his face and in his voice when he was frustrated or angry with me. And he would look at me and he'd say, "You stink on ice. You just stink on ice," he would say to me. Now, I didn't quite know what that meant, stinking on ice. I didn't realize what the reference was, but I knew it wasn't good to stink. And I took that message in from my father as potently as I took in the message that you're number four, remember that? And that's what yellow trucks do. I took it in, and I was a child. I had no boundaries. I couldn't look at it and say, "Well, Dad, what's going on with you that you would say something like that to me? I took it in and said, "This must be true. This is my father. And therefore, there must be something wrong with me. I stink on ice." Now, some of you may know the reference to that when he grew up in another part of Queens decades earlier, when they had an ice box, not a refrigerator, but an ice box. If you wanted to keep a fish fresh, you put it on ice. And if a fish stank, even after being put on ice, that fish was really bad. It had gone really bad. So when he would be frustrated or angry with me, he would say, "You stink on ice." Now, I have an earlier memory of my father. When my mother would drive me to the subway station to pick him up, and he would come down from the elevated subway station, come down. I'd be playing there in the dirt, and I would run up to my father. And I remember, and I was younger than kindergarten at this point, because the stink on ice message showed up more later, kindergarten and later, when I was really a youngster. He would throw me into the air, and I would squeal with delight and feel totally trusting that he would catch me. There was no fear. I was just delighted, and I was high up in the air, and he would catch me, and it was a moment of pure joy. But that didn't last in my family. It didn't last with my father. And my father was born in 1917. When he was my daughter's age, my daughter is now 24. When he was 24 in 1941, he joined the military. This is prior to Pearl Harbor, because he wanted to get his military service done with. He said, "I'll go in for a year and be done with it." Well, in that year, 1941, in December, the United States entered World War II. And he was in for the, you know, duration plus 6 months. He emerged from that war. He was a combat veteran in World War II in Europe. He rose from the rank of private, became a lieutenant, led a platoon. He was awarded two Purple Hearts and the Bronze Star. And he emerged from that conflict, having seen his buddies killed and maimed. He was lieutenant. He felt a great sense of responsibility for all of them. But he emerged from that war, as many from his generation did, traumatized, post-traumatic stress disorder, none of which could be named or even was understood. But his whole generation of men at that age, that period, he was a man in his 20s at that point, never spoke about it, never talked about their experiences. All I knew about my father's experiences in the war was the equipment in the basement that my friends and I played with when we played war out on the street. I remember his helmet. I remember his helmet was very heavy on my head when I use it to play with. I tell you about this because it plays a role in an amends that I later tried to and did make with my father after I had done program, after I had come to new assumptions about what life was about, and I had used program tools to more and more free myself up from the legacy of growing up with him as my father. When I was able to use program tools to realize that I actually didn't stink on ice, but that my father was troubled, and my father was in physical pain because of recurring ulcers, never could be cured, that he was traumatized and bitter and had shaped a worldview that limited his ability to be loving towards me as his son. One lesson that I learned that was I wanted to share with you as I did the Al-Anon program around adult children issues was I realized at a certain point in my recovery that I had been looking to my father as my higher power. He was my father in my mind with a big F rather than my father with a little F. It was a major realization for me when I would work the steps and began to have a relationship with the higher power of my own understanding that I could identify as God, God the Father, God the Mother. For me, that worked. So as I was able to withdraw from him the role of being my father in heaven, I began to see that he was another man in the world, that he was a man who had his traumatic experiences that had shaped him, that had made him bitter, and had prompted him to, I think well-intentioned, to deliver what he thought was wisdom about life. Let me tell you about some of the assumptions that I learned from him that he taught me in life. And I'm not doing this in a blameful way, but as a factual way. My father in my family and my mother also reinforced the message that it's really important not to trust anyone because people would do you wrong. This was an explicit message that I was delivered, and they offered it to me as a way to protect myself in life. They offered me the message that life is to be feared. Life is to be feared. Bad things will happen sooner or later. Now, my background as a family was a Jewish. My mother and father were both first generation immigrants. Their parents had all come from Russia and Eastern Europe. So there was a message handed down that it wasn't a question of if the Cossacks were going to be coming to destroy your village. It was a question of when. So there was an intergenerational message that was being passed, but my parents passed that message on to me. Don't trust anyone. And be careful, because once you enter the real world, it was going to be a scary place. So, of course, the message was one of fear. It was an explicit message also that life is filled with sorrow. Not a question of if, but a question of when. And that when sorrow would hit, you were going to suffer. I got the message from my example with my dad that men are distant and critical, and that's what's to be expected from men. And by correlation, that's what's to be expected from God. And there was a message that depend on women, but don't disappoint them. And there was also a very explicit message, God doesn't exist. And if he does, watch out. So these were the assumptions, these were the lessons, these were the you're number four, remember this type of message that I was given. But through the program, and this is really the beauty of this program, the Al-Anon program, let me just say, blows me out of the water. I've studied in my life a lot of spiritual systems. I have done a lot of psychological study and psychological work on myself and with others for decades. The Al-Anon program is a blending of psychological, emotional healing, and spiritual healing, which really are not separate, put together in a package that we can do that in community, that we can turn to each other and trust each other and have a community of fellow travelers, and does it in a way that shares this new learning open to all, available to all, for free. You just have to show up and participate. It's mind-boggling. You know, when I think about the 12-step program, this program was Bill W. back in the 1930s. This program emerged from the depths of the National Depression. It wasn't just Bill W.'s depression and the alcoholic disease that he was dealing with and Dr. Bob and the others. The whole nation was consumed with a depression and consumed with fear during the 1930s. And out of that crucible, the 12-step, this homegrown program, American homegrown program, not organized by a corporation, not a government program, not an institutional program, but really, seriously, from the people. The most grassroots thing you can think of emerges from the people and spreads over the decades since then to a worldwide movement of healing, blending together spiritual principles that includes everyone. I mean, I just say this out loud to drive home the staggering nature of what we get to participate in. It's just a blessing. So that was a little bit of a footnote or aside here, right? So I'm going back to now talking about how the program helped me change my assumptions about my father to help me free myself up from the legacy of You Stink on Ice. So a major realization for me is when I realized through program that my father was another man in the world, and I could view him that way. He was not my higher power. I could begin to experiment and explore the idea that there was a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity, could restore me to serenity, because to me, that's what sobriety is in Al-Anon, is having a sense of serenity. That was revelatory to me, and I was able to practice that. And from that place, and from other experiences that happened as I worked the program, I began to realize that the very thing that frustrated my father with me, what really frustrated my father with me, was that he so much needed and was desperate for my attention and my appreciation and my acknowledgement as his son. The very things that I had been looking to him for as my father to give to me as his son. You have a sense of what I'm saying here? He was looking to me, not that he ever said that, but when he would get frustrated with me because I would not pay attention to when he wanted to teach me something, or I got frustrated, he got impatient with me because he had a very low threshold of patience. What he was looking for was validation, appreciation, and acknowledgement, rather than understanding that as the father, it was his role to give that to me as his son. When that realization hit me, I was so freed, because I realized that my awareness, which I gained from the program, that was what was going on. I could now have this space, if I so chose to do, I could give that to him. And in doing so, make an amends to him that I could not be the son that he needed, and that he could not be the father that I needed. So from that place, one of the first amends I tried to make and did make with him was I wrote him a letter. This was in 1992. I wrote him a 3-page letter, and I really had to focus on this. What did I gain positive from my father? What did he offer from his example? What did I extract and look beyond the You Stink on Ice statements? What could I look beyond that I could acknowledge him for? And I wrote him this 3-page letter. I had it professionally framed. I shipped it to him in Florida. And I said, Dad, you're about to be 75. I was then, I think, 44, 42. And let me give you this gift of appreciation for what you have given me and how you have shaped me to be the man I am today. That was very freeing to do that. A couple years later, I was sitting in meditation. Well, let me insert something here. After many decades, what happened with the men of World War II was they began to come together and have conventions of their infantry. In this case, my father was in the 99th Infantry Division. They would come together in conventions once or twice a year in a different city, and invite. They would all come with their wives and get together and begin to do what they couldn't do after the war, which was to swap memories, reconnect, reminisce, and be there for each other. And this became a very important part of my father's life, the 99th Division infantry conventions that happened in different cities around the country. And I would know he and my mother would go, and all the men and their wives would go. Now, these are men who were then in their 70s and 80s getting together. And he would tell me about these, that he, you know, always enjoyed these. So I was meditating one day, 1993, and it occurred to me, he had a convention coming up in Denver. And I swear this was a higher power intervention. And it came, the idea came to me, it was time for me to acknowledge my father for the in a new way, in front of his peers, at one of his 99th Infantry Division conventions. So unbeknownst to him, I contacted the organizer of the convention, introduced myself, said, I'm the son of one of your members. I would like to come to your convention in Denver, if I could, and offer a toast to the men of the 99th on behalf of my generation. This idea had come to me. This was now... this was about 50 years after World War II, and you may remember there was a lot of, you know, reports in the news and stuff about veterans, and there was attention on it—the 50th anniversary of World War II. So I, convention organizer said, "That sounds like a good idea. Please do so." And I was going to do that as a surprise to my father. I told him, "I'd like to join you at the convention. Is that okay?" And he said, "Sure." And my mother said, "Sure." And I arranged to. Take a flight from San Francisco to Denver. Now, I've also learned in program that God loves a good drama. And here's how God had a good drama that day. I get to the airport. The convention is that day. The dinner is that evening. And I show up at the Oakland airport, San Francisco airport, and I'm hanging out in the lounge, and the flight is canceled. The flight is canceled to Denver. And I had planned it just to, you know, enough time to get there. And I call up my father and mother and say, the flight's canceled. Now, my mother, bless her heart, she says, okay, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. You don't have to come. I say, I'm coming. And lo and behold, God opened the door and there was a seat on a plane to Denver a couple hours after that. I get to the Denver airport. I hop in a cab, like in the movies, I say, you know, follow that car. No, you know, here's an extra 20 in it for you. If you get me to this convention center in the next half hour. And this taxi driver bus is asked to get there. And I walk in as the convention dinner is starting. We've got 500, 1,000, I'm not sure what the number was, men in their 70s and their 80s in this big convention hall with their wives, sitting at tables of eight. And there's my father and mother sitting at their table. And I walk in, they wave me over, come on over, come on over. Just in time. I go over to the convention organizer on the side, say, I'm here. If you want to introduce me at some point during the ceremony, do that. So I'm sitting there with my father. He's very pleased. I'm the only one of my age. I'm 40, in my 40s sitting there with, you know, and my father doesn't know why I'm there other than to support him. So the convention guy gets up at a certain point and says, we have a special surprise for you today. And we have the son of one of our members here today wants to say something. I get up from the table. And my father sees me get up. He's 79, 76 years old. He sees me get up. He says, sit down, sit down. What are you doing? Sit down, sit down. I go up to the podium. My father's in shock. I go up to the podium, and I stood on this podium. And again, this is my amends to my father. And I'm standing on this podium with an American flag behind me. And I gave the following toast to the men of the 99th, the 44th annual convention. This is what they called it. I would like to offer a toast. My name is Jason, and I am the son of one among you here today, First Lieutenant Cy Saffer. Dad, would you stand up for just a moment? And I had my father stand up in front of 500 to 1,000 people, half of whom were his buddies from the 99th Infantry Division. Said, my father was with the 295th Regiment, 1st Battalion, B Company, and also with the 3rd Battalion, L Company. Thanks, Dad. And I continued, I was born after the war in 1949, and I've come here to Denver today from California to offer you, the men of the 99th, this toast. You successfully fought and overcame an evil that threatened to take over the world. It is because of you, and each of your buddies who isn't here today, that we live in a country that flies the American flag and not a Nazi swastika. It was your commitment, your courage, and your perseverance that made the crucial difference. I'm speaking this to my father and his buddies. I come to you today representing the generation that came after, the generation of your children, to thank you and to honor you. Because of you and because of what you accomplished, the men and women of my generation, your sons and daughters, were able to grow up free. On behalf of myself and all of them, I offer you this toast of thanks. You may not think of yourself as heroes, but believe me, gentlemen, you are. Thank you, and God bless you. Now, I want you to know, people were weeping. I feel tearful as I say these words to you again so many years later. I weep now, not only for what about the truth of that in terms of what that generation did for us, but I weep that I was able to find it in my heart to offer that to my father, who had so hurt me as a child, that because of my changed attitude that I had learned in Al-Anon, because of the support of people, you, who come to these meetings and share your strength, hope, and experience, I was able to shift off of my judgment and blame and sense of injury so that I could free my father to be who he is and free myself from the legacy of who he is. So I am so profoundly grateful that we do this together, that we have this opportunity in this age, even in the midst of COVID, that we still, through God's grace, are able to, gather together to this technology, which wasn't here 5 years ago, 10 years ago, if this had happened then. So I so appreciate God's handiwork in all the ways that we can understand him. I'll finish by saying, when I was learning and still practicing the third step, second, third, I'm getting confused now, came to understand, now I'm a little blocked, but to come to understand the God of my understanding, to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood God, I used to think that that meant that I could not turn my life over until I understood God. And for years, that was a blockage for me until I realized one day at a program meeting, that I don't understand God, nor am I supposed to. I don't have to understand the big plan, the big picture. I don't have to agree with it all the time. I don't have to like it. It doesn't have to fit my pictures in order to trust it. Thank you for the opportunity to be here and to share this with you today.
Wow. Thank you, Jason.